A photon checked into a hotel, and the bellhop asked it if it had any luggage. The photon said, "No, I'm traveling light." I'll be here all week. Or maybe not. I don't know. Today we're going to talk about the traveling light, Jesus Christ. Matthew 9, 35 through 38. Jesus traveled through all the towns and villages, teaching in their synagogues, proclaiming the good news of the kingdom, and healing every disease and sickness. When he saw the crowds, he had compassion on them because they were harassed and helpless, like sheep without a shepherd. Then he said to his disciples, "The harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few. Ask the Lord of the harvest, therefore, to send out workers into his harvest field." Not all of us here are traveling workers in the field like the disciples were, and later Timothy and Titus and the other evangelists. But this doesn't lessen our responsibility to shine our light wherever we go. Jesus was requesting for us to be workers in the field. Let's review the punchline for this week. Matthew 5, 14 through 16. "You are the light of the world. A city that's set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do they light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven." Probably the most important reason that we need to shine our light before men is to expose the most fundamental problem of mankind: the incompatibility of God with man. That light and darkness cannot exist together. That they are in contention with each other. We know that yesterday we learned that God is light, and in him there is no darkness at all. 1 John 1 and 5. How do we put that together with Romans 3 and 23, "For all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God"? And what are the wages of that sin? Death. Romans 6 and 23. So if God is not compatible with darkness, and we have darkness, the conclusion is inescapable. We will be thrown outside into the darkness where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Matthew 8, 12. Unless something happens to us. The darkness of man cannot exist with the light of God, and we are lost. A passage that I want to focus on this morning is 1 Timothy 6 and 16. 1 Timothy 6 and 16. "God, who alone is immortal and who lives in unapproachable light, whom no one has seen or can see." That's a problematic verse. It is a real problem for us if God is unapproachable. Why is he unapproachable to us? With the exception of what we saw last week, the President of the United States and most leaders in the world are unapproachable. If you don't believe me, you could try to run up on stage sometime. See what happens. It'll probably end badly for you. Might end in a lot of pain. They are unapproachable. Why are they unapproachable? They're unapproachable because they're being protected from you. They're being protected from man. Why is God unapproachable? God is unapproachable because we are being protected from him. We are dark. What would his light do to us? We would be vanquished. We are being protected from God, and that is why he is unapproachable to us. I told Joanne I didn't have any light bulb chats today, and she got really upset with that. something about, I'd rather talk with other people than listen to you. I can't remember exactly how the quote was. It was something like that. You could ask her later. I'm sure she'd probably tell you things I don't want to hear. But anyway, I came up with one that I thought I could insert here, and it fit in here with what I want to kind of talk about a little bit. And so here's your light bulb chat for today. It's the only one you're going to get. Sorry. I'm only going to give you 60 seconds, and it's kind of I had a hard time kind of writing the question, because in the verse that we just read right there, it says that whom no one has seen. Okay? So the question is, who in the Bible saw God? And so I know you don't want to answer it because, that just verse said that no one's seen him, so now we'd be lying if that has to be the truth. And it is the truth. But there's a lot of examples of people that seem to kind of see God, or at least even claim that they saw God. I saw God face to face. You know, those are some real specific examples of people that saw God and maybe were even worried about it. So I'm going to give you 60 seconds, and you can turn to your elbow partner and discuss real quickly with people that you think in the Bible had an experience with God or saw God or said that they saw God. All right. Okay, we're done. We're done. We're done. Stop talking. All right, so that wasn't enough time, I don't think. I knew it wasn't going to be enough time because we can talk about a million things. So who wants to yell one out? Moses. Okay, Moses is going to be the one we're primarily going to be talking about here. Did Moses see God's face? I always like to ask the questions where I know Charles is going to say yes, no, because there's a lot of them, okay? So, yeah, we'll talk about that here in a little bit. Who? Another one?
Adam and Eve.
Adam and Eve? How'd that happen?
They walked with God in the garden.
Did they walk with God in the garden?
They heard the sound of the Lord God walking in the garden.
Okay.
Okay.
There we got our answer, so... They heard the sound of God walking in the cool of the day in the garden, right? And they were there, and they talked with him and stuff. So Charles says that that's affirmation of that. So another one. Huh? Samson's parents. Yeah. Samson's parents are some of my favorite people. That is a good story. I like that story. Manoah, right? We don't know... We have Manoah and Manoah's wife, right? I like that story because that's the reverse of me and my wife. So, Manoah and Manoah's wife. We don't know her name. But Manoah says something that is one of my favorite things in the Bible. He prays, Lord, tell me how to raise this boy. And I love that part. So Manoah is really, really good. But then later on, after the angel has told them all these things and they've offered sacrifices to him and everything, and all of a sudden Manoah realizes that it was the angel of God, right? And he says, we are doomed to die. We've seen God, right? And what does his wife say? Calm down. Some of these stories are just so good, you know. Relax. Number one. She starts listing things, right? You know, she says, number one, why would he have accepted our offering? He just accepted our offering. Number two, why did he show us all these things? And number three, why did he tell us how to raise our son if we're going to be dead? You know, and then there, Manoah says nothing else. It's just done. The story moves on. She had the child, you know. It's just so good. But was that God? Well, Manoah said, I saw God, but it was an angel. It was some manifestation, kind of in a kind of a human form kind of things. And a lot of these things are, right? They're kind of a theophany. There's kind of a manifestation of maybe part of the glory of God, but not the full glory of God. That's a good one. What else? Stephen. Yeah. I'm going to come back to Stephen here in a little bit. Who else? Anyone that saw Christ on the earth, yes. Okay, that's cheating. All right. Anybody else?
John,
yep, in the vision, right? And we have Ezekiel in the visions, right, that they had. Anybody else?
Moses.
We have Moses.
Named after by you and 70 elders.
Okay. Jacob, right? Jacob, right, he named the place, what is it, Peniel, I think, and said that because I saw the face of God and I lived, right? I survived, right? But Hosea actually says that he wrestled with an angel, you know, instead. It wasn't necessarily God, but it was a manifestation maybe of the power of God. Isaiah, in Isaiah 6, right? He's right before he said, you know, here am I, send me. He said, I am ruined. My eyes have seen the King, the Lord Almighty, right? Another vision there. Back to Stephen. So there's a lot of them. There's more. We could talk about Gideon. I had Job. We didn't have Jesus, obviously. I think we hit most of them. Abraham. But back to Stephen. So Stephen's interesting, I think, to me, because in Acts 7, what does it say? Okay, so that is what he says to the people, right? He says, I see Jesus standing on the right hand of God, right? And that's what makes them go crazy, right? They just stopped their ears. They couldn't stand it, and they just kind of went crazy on him. That's what he said he saw, but what did he see? What's the wording of what he did see? I saw the glory of God, right? I looked up to heaven and saw the glory of God and Jesus standing on the right hand of God. When he says it, he says, I saw Jesus standing on the right hand of God. But when it says what he saw, it says that the heavens opened and I saw the glory of God. Was that the fullness of the glory of God?
No, it was the same thing, or similar to what Moses and the elders and Isaiah and others saw.
Okay. That's what Charles says is the answer again. So, I don't know. To me, if I'm gonna pick one person that I think maybe saw the glory of God fully, then it might have been Stephen. But Moses, of course, says, or God says, no one can see my face and they will die. But what did Stephen do? He died almost instantly after that. Now it was because he was stoned, but I don't know that, you know, it says he saw the glory of God and Jesus on the right side, and he died. He was stoned by the people, but I love that part there, because if I'm going to be stoned by the people, which I just can't imagine that happening, but what a gift God gave him, right? What a gift God gave him. And maybe, you know, he's going to die right now because of the people anyway. I'm going to let him see my presence. And we're mortal. If we're mortal, we cannot see God. That's the key. We cannot see God without dying. He is too almighty and too powerful for us. We're going to be spending some time in the book of Exodus, if you want to turn to Exodus chapter 19. And we're going to talk a lot more about Moses. We've been talking about Moses yesterday. Moses is the person that said, here am I, please send somebody else, right? Unlike Isaiah. And if you go to Exodus 19, I'm going to read quite a few passages here through the book of Exodus. We'll start in verses 12 through 13. Put limits for the people around the mountain and tell them, be careful that you do not approach the mountain or touch the foot of it. Whoever touches the mountain is to be put to death. They are to be stoned or shot with arrows. Not a hand is to be laid on them. No person or animal should be permitted to live. Only when the ram's horn sounds a long blast may they approach the mountain. Let's drop down to verse 16. On the morning of the third day, there was thunder and lightning with a thick cloud over the mountain and a very loud trumpet blast. Everyone in the camp trembled. Then Moses led the people out of the camp to meet with God. And they stood at the foot of the mountain. Mount Sinai was covered with smoke because the Lord descended on it in fire. The smoke billowed up from it like smoke from a furnace, and the whole mountain trembled violently. Do we have light here or do we have darkness? We kind of have both, don't we? We definitely have the light of God. He's in the fire. He's in the lightning. But what is also coming up, there is a cloud, a dark cloud. There's the smoke that's billowing up. It's frightening. Very frightening to the people. The light and the dark is very, very frightening here. 19, verse 19. As the sound of the trumpet grew louder and louder, Moses spoke, and the voice of God answered him. The Lord descended to the top of Mount Sinai and called Moses to the top of the mountain. So Moses went up, and the Lord said to him, "Go down and warn the people, so they did not force their way through to see the Lord, and many of them perish. Even the priests who approach the Lord must consecrate themselves, or the Lord will break out against them." Moses said to the Lord, "The people cannot come up Mount Sinai because you yourself warned us. Put limits around the mountain and set it apart as holy." The Lord replied, "Go down and bring Aaron up with you, but the priests and the people must not force their way through to come up to the Lord, or he will break out against them." So Moses went down to the people and told them. God was unapproachable to the people to protect the people. He warns them, "You can't come close to me. You are darkness, I am light. If you come close to me, I will break out against you." But who could approach God? Moses. Moses could approach God. They had an advocate in Moses. Moses was a good and humble man. He was allowed into the presence of God. And in fact, if we skip ahead, chapter 33, and we read in the 11th verse, the Lord would speak to Moses face to face as one speaks to a friend. So we have this passage in here that people like to point out. Oh, there's contradictions in the Bible, right? He'd speak to face to face. Did he speak face to face? No, he didn't speak face to face. We know he didn't speak face to face, right? Because God tells him, "You can't speak to my face," right? And when God speaks, it's true. Okay, so when we hear this passage, what does this mean? Well, if this is just a phrase, a face to face. It's a Hebrew phrase that means, you know, more than most people, but within the presence of God, right? That he could speak as a friend. Abraham was called a friend of God as well. So face-to-face doesn't necessarily mean that we're just seeing the entire glory of God. And if we go down to verse 19 in chapter 33, if you're still with me there. And the Lord said, "I will cause my goodness to pass in front of you, and I will proclaim my name, the Lord, in your presence. I will have mercy on whom I have mercy, and I will compassion on whom I have compassion." But he said, "You cannot see my face, for no one may see me and live." Then the Lord said, "There is a place near me where you may stand on a rock. When my glory passes by, I will put you in a cleft in the rock, and I'll cover you with my hand until I have passed by. Then I will remove my hand, and you will see my back, but my face must not be seen." It's always interesting to me, his hand, his back, his face, the finger of God. You know, we're created in his image. There's body parts that God himself mentions. In Matthew 5, when we shine our light before men, it should be the light of God that we are reflecting in our faces. So somehow I need to be able to approach God in the presence like Moses was. Somehow I need that to be able to happen for me so I can radiate my face outwards to other people. That light would stand out in a dark world. That light would be noticeable. That light would command attention so that we could tell the world about God's commands for them. It'd be nice if we could approach God in some way and have that happen. Go on to verse chapter 34 in Exodus 29, verse 29 through 30, we'll read first. When Moses came down from Mount Sinai with the two tablets of the covenant law in his hands, he was not aware that his face was radiant because he had spoken with the Lord. When Aaron and all the Israelites saw Moses, his face was radiant, and they were afraid to come near him. Not only were they afraid of the mountain, they were afraid of Moses. Moses comes down and he's radioactive. He's glowing. It would just be completely fearful. It sounds to me, when I'm reading this, that they literally ran away from him. They literally ran away from him. In verse 31, but Moses called to them, so Aaron and all the leaders of the community came back to him. You know, and they had run away. They all said, come back here, it's fine. They came back to him and he spoke to them. Afterward, all the Israelites came near him and he gave them all the commands the Lord had given him on Mount Sinai. When Moses finished speaking to them, he put a veil over his face. But whenever he entered the Lord's presence to speak with him, he removed the veil until he came out. And when he came out and told the Israelites what had been commanded, they saw that his face was radiant. Then Moses would put the veil back over his face until he went in to speak with the Lord. We're going to speak more about the veil probably later this week, so we're not going to get too deep into it right now. Moses could answer the call of Matthew 5 very easily. Moses could shine his light on those around him. He couldn't even help it. This was just the way it was. Moses' face could reflect the light of God because he was able to approach him. But to the rest of the people, God remained unapproachable. So how can we shine our light on others? There needed to be a solution to the sin problem that we talked about at the beginning. Mankind desperately needed someone more worthy than Moses as its mediator. The world needed God himself. And God knew it. So God came to us because we could not approach him. He sent us his son, the traveling light. The light traveled from God to the earth. The old covenant under Moses showed us that we couldn't approach him. So the new covenant, in the new covenant, he approached us. Hebrews 3:3-6 says, Jesus has been found worthy of greater honor than Moses, just as the builder of a house has greater honor than the house itself, for every house is built by someone, but God is the builder of everything. Moses was faithful as a servant in God's house, bearing witness to what would be spoken by God in the future, but Christ is faithful as the Son over God's house. And we are his house. We are his house, if indeed we hold firmly to our confidence and the hope in which we glory. The traveling light had come to the world. If you go to John 7 and 8, it's the time for there's three feasts that they had to pilgrimage to Jerusalem. And it's the time in John 7 and 8 as the Feast of the Tabernacles, sometimes called the Feast of the Booths. In my family, we call the Feast of Tabernacles the Midwest Bible Campout. We pilgrimage to Eminence and we stay in tents for 8 days. And hopefully there, no one's trying to kill us. But in the beginning of John 7, we find out that it's the Feast of the Tabernacles, and the Jews were plotting to do what? To extinguish the light, right? They're plotting to take Jesus' life. Jesus doesn't go down there right away, right? Who's trying to get him to go down there? His brothers are. If you want to be something, go on down. Shine your light. Let everybody see. Go on down there. And the brothers knew that they were down there. It says that the Jews were trying to kill him, and the brothers were trying to get him to go on down there. There's a parenthesis there that says, because even they did not believe him at this time, right? Even they did not believe him at this time. Does Jesus go down? Yes, he goes down a little while later, right? It says goes down kind of secretly, okay? And he goes down to the Feast of the Tabernacles. What was the Feast of the Tabernacles? The Feast of the Tabernacles was a great celebration, whole week, and it was commemorating the escape from Egypt, right? Moses leading them out of Egypt and through the wilderness, and that's why it was called the Feast of Tabernacles. They would go to this thing, and they'd build these little shelters out of palm branches and sticks and things that they could stay in, and there was just a big community of people in tents. And it was very fun and exciting for them, I'm sure. It was really, really good. Just as exciting as it is for us when we get together at the camp out. We enjoy that time together, and I'm sure that they enjoyed the time together as well. I tried to find a cool picture because Charles has the topic that he gets all to show all the cool pictures. I was telling Ginger, it's like, he gets to show all these awesome pictures. So I found a picture. It's not a real picture. It's kind of a drawing. This is the temple, and there's a big court outside, and that's and everybody can go into there. Everybody can go into there. It's called the Court of the Gentiles. All the Gentiles can go in there too, Roman soldiers, everybody. But in here, right here in the front is another court, and this is called the Court of Women. It's the Court of Women, right? Is that only the women get to go in there? No, it's called the Court of Women because all the Jews can go in there, and all the Gentiles can go in there, but the women can go in there. They can't go any further than that, but the husbands can take their wives into this courtyard in here. And in this courtyard, the Court of Women, there were a whole bunch of collection boxes where people could donate their money for the temple, right? This is the place where Jesus was in Luke 21 when he was sitting in there in the Court of Women and he was watching people. And what did he see? He saw a widow, right, that came and gave two mites because she could be there. Because she was a woman and she could come in there and she could give her money there. And we have a great story in that particular place. So this is where the festival of Tabernacles was kind of primarily occurring. And during this feast, they had this illumination of the temple ceremony. Basically, it was all week. And they had these four huge candelabras, 75 feet tall. That's what I'm reading about. And they have these big golden bowls on the top, and they have these priests that would go up the ladders, and they would ignite the oil, and it would just illuminate the entire Temple Mount. You could see the light in Jerusalem in the entire temple. This is the setting of where Jesus was going to be preaching in the Feast of Tabernacles here in the Court of Women. These candelabras, all of this lit up, had really two representations. The first representation is probably pretty obvious. It's the Feast of Tabernacles. They're being led out of Egypt through the wilderness. What does the light represent? The pillar of fire, right? It says it represents the light of God in the pillar of fire that led them out of Egypt. They're giving credit to God for leading them out of Egypt. But the other thing that it represented was a promise to Moses about a Messiah, right? A promise about a Messiah that would bring light into the world in Deuteronomy 18:18. I will raise up for them a prophet like you from among the brethren. I will put my words in his mouth and he will tell them everything I command him. Everybody, the Jews knew what Moses had been promised about this Messiah that was to come. Did they realize it was Jesus? That's the problem. They were told it was Jesus, right? In Acts 3, remember when Acts 3, Peter and John went one day up to the temple to pray, right? And they found a crippled man, they healed him, and everybody's like amazed about it. He goes, why are you amazed about this? Like, this is our doing. We didn't do this. Who'd they give credit to? They gave credit to Jesus. It was the power of Jesus that you rejected, and this is the prophet that Moses prophesied about. Peter ties Jesus with this prophecy specifically to them. Acts 7, back to Stephen. What does Stephen say? This Jesus is the one that Moses prophesied about. And Stephen ties Jesus to the prophecy as well and quotes Deuteronomy 18 and 18. Did Jesus quote Deuteronomy 18 and 18? Not verbatim like Peter and Stephen did. But in John 5:46, he says, if you believed Moses, you would believe me, for he wrote about me. Jesus is claiming, I am that Messiah. I am that prophet that Moses was preaching about. And I mention all this kind of background history here because in John 8 and 20, kind of right after he does his speech there, and we haven't talked about a speech yet, and right there in the Court of Women. In John 8 and 20, it says, he spoke these words while teaching in the temple courts near the place where the offerings were put. So we know where he is. He's in this court of women when he's preaching these words. Yet no one seized him because his hour had not yet come. He was in the court of women because he was preaching to men and the women. He was preaching to all the Jewish people. He wasn't out in the court of Gentiles. He says, other sheep have I, and they're out there. They're out there in that other sheep pen outside here, and I'm going to talk to them too. But right now, I'm talking to you. And what does he say? John 8 and 12. Underneath those candelabras, illumination of the temple, Jesus is preaching to the world, and he says, I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. Imagine that setting. Here's all this light. It represents God taking you out of Egypt and bondage. Look at me. I am the light of the world. I will take you out of sin. I will take you out of bondage. Jesus was the light of the world. The people walking in darkness have seen a great light on those living in the land of deep darkness. A light has dawned. Isaiah 9 and 2. The sun is the radiance of God's glory, the exact representation of his being. Hebrews 1 and 3. As Jesus himself said to Nicodemus, this is the verdict. Light has come into the world. John 3, 19. For God, who said, let light shine out of darkness, made his light shine in our hearts to give us the light of the knowledge of God's glory, the light of God's knowledge of God's glory displayed in the face of Christ. 2 Corinthians 4 and 6. Notice the reference, I think, to Moses there. Displayed in the face of Christ. Christ is our new Moses. He's a more perfect Moses. He's a more worthy Moses. And also a few chapters later in John, then Jesus cried out, whoever believes in me does not believe in me only, but in the one who sent me. The one who looks at me is seeing the one who sent me. I have come into the world as a light so that no one who believes in me should stay in darkness. John 12, 44 through 46. If you will, turn with me to Philippians chapter 2. We'll look at verses 6 and 7. Verse 6 can read quite differently, depending on your version that you have today. I'm going to put King James Version here on the screen. Who being in the very form of God, thought it not robbery to be equal with God, but made himself of no reputation, and took upon him the form of a servant, and was made in the likeness of men. Your version might have read somewhat quite differently. There's a whole bunch of different phrases there that are used a little bit differently. And the problem kind of comes in the Greek word that is used here for robbery, harpagamos, if I'm saying that right. And that word means to clutch or to seize or to hold on to grasp, to keep in your clutches. My NIV reads, who being in very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be grasped. And I don't really like that, because does it saying that he's not really God? There's phrases there that kind of make it sound like he's not really God, but my first phrase says, who being in very nature God, it says like, although he was God, he decided that he wouldn't be God, or it's very kind of confusing. The way, what it means here is that he is God, he is in very nature God, but he didn't grasp or take his deity as something that he was going to hold on to and use for his advantage while he was here in front of us. That's the Herman translation, I guess. That's what it means. It means that he's not clutching or just holding on. I mean, I'm going to hold on to my deity at every given moment. I'm going to lay it down. I'm going to lay it down to show these people how much I love them so that they can approach me. If I don't lay that down, they're not going to be able to approach me. So Jesus had to kind of lay this down. It means to not choose to or display his divinity to its fullest extent or for his own advantage. My NIV goes on, it says, he made himself nothing. He became a servant. He took on human likeness. See, he didn't hold on to his deity. He gave it up so that we could approach him. There is a brief moment in the Bible where Jesus did kind of use his divinity. He kind of took his human likeness off and he exposed his glory only to three people, right? And it was pretty terrifying. Do you remember what three people it was that he exposed that to? Peter, James, and John, right? Peter, James, and John. I like those guys. You know, the transfiguration is mentioned in just the Synoptic Gospels. It's not actually mentioned in John, which I always thought is kind of interesting. I kind of think that maybe, you know, Luke is one of my favorite people because he just investigated. You know, he just went and he asked all the people that were there, right? So sometimes I feel like maybe John's account is maybe what we find in Luke. I don't know. But John, I would think that, you know, John said, I'm giving you these things because these are the things you need to know, right? John was very, very unique in his writing. But if we look at these three passages, Matthew 17, 1 and 6, I'm so glad we have different viewpoints. Matthew 17, 1 and 6, it says that I'll read it. His face shone like the sun and his clothes became as white as light. But Mark says his clothes were whiter than anyone could bleach them. And Luke says his clothes were as bright as a flash of lightning. Are they all saying this different thing? No, they're saying, I can't describe it, but it was really, really bright. The glory of Jesus was amazing. It was amazing when Jesus let them see this. Peter, James, and John. You know, sometimes people say that, well, they were part of the inner circle, you know. But I don't know. I'm a father. And sometimes I wonder if Jesus has said, I need these guys close by me so I can keep an eye on them. You know, I mean, think about those three guys, Peter, James, and John, right? We have the Sons of Thunder around here somewhere, I think, Sons of Thunder, you know. James and John, they were the, what do you call it? The OG Sons of Thunder, right? The originals, Sons of Thunder, right? Come on, Lord, let's put fire down on them. You know, let's go, you know? What did they also do? They said, hey, when we have the kingdom, can me and my brother be like the number one people? You know, can you imagine the other apostles going, what is this, you know? And then Peter, you know, we talked about yesterday about, you know, seeming really bright until you open your mouth. That's Peter. Peter just could not help himself sometimes, and he just had to say something. And so when I read the Transfiguration, I know I'm supposed to be in awe of everything, but sometimes I'm like, this situation is, I can just imagine all three of them standing there. The Son of God in all his glory, Moses, Elijah, how do they even know who that is? I'm sure it's just given to them, you know, or Jesus is talking. They're having a conversation. Luke says they're having a conversation about Jesus' upcoming death. They're having a deep conversation. They're probably not even paying attention to these three guys over here. And what are they doing? I just imagine they're looking at each other like, you say something, you know. It's like, come on, you guys wanted to be number one and two in the kingdom. Now's your chance. Say something. You know, this isn't scripture. It's just my brain thinking, what is happening here? And of course, they're talking back to Peter, you know, well, you're the rock. He called you the rock. Be a rock. Say something. And of course, who says something? Peter. He can't help it. He starts talking. And what does he say? It's hilarious. I'm sorry, but it's funny. I think it's funny. Oh, it's such a good thing that we're here today. I mean, what a coincidence. There's three of us. There's three of you. We could each build a little house for you. I just can't. I don't even understand it. It's like Peter and John, or Peter and James, or James and John, just had to be looking at Peter like, what are you saying, you know? How long did Peter talk? Not long. How come? Because God interrupted him. right? And it's great what God says, right? It's the second time God has said this. It says, while Peter was talking, God says, "This is my son, whom I love, in whom I am well pleased. Listen to him." And I have exclamation points in my Bible on that. Listen to him. Peter, stop talking. Listen to him. He is the light. Listen to him. And what did they do? It says they were enveloped in a cloud of light and they fell to the ground and didn't look up. That was the response. That was the response. We just don't have the response all the time that we should have. I'm going to have to move. John 17, at the end of his ministry, he prayed to the Father these words. Jesus prayed to the Father, "I have brought your glory on the earth. I have brought you glory on the earth by completing the work you gave me to do. And now, Father, glorify me in your presence with the glory I had with you before the world began." This is the glory that he relinquished, that he didn't hold on to or cling to in Philippians chapter 2. He restrained his divine power when the devil tempted him to turn stone into bread, didn't he? He could have done something, he didn't. He restrained his divine power when he told Peter he could call 12 legions of angels when he was arrested. He could have done that, he didn't do that. He lowered himself. And my all-time favorite, he restrained his divine power when the people taunted him, "Come down from the cross and save yourself." That would have been too much for me. I daydream about the things I would have done to them in that moment. But he didn't do that. All these things he could have done, but he humbled himself, even to the death of a cross. He was God, and he did have the power to do all these things, but he emptied himself. Or as the King James Version says, he made himself of no reputation. He suppressed his divine nature, and he appeared as a man, which changed everything. It made him approachable. In other words, Jesus came to the world to be a kind of a filter so that a man could finally approach the unapproachable light of God. When I first taught my boys how to play chess, I refrained from crushing them in 10 moves. And before they say anything, I don't play them anymore because they're not as compassionate to me now. But I wanted them to become better. I wanted them to feel comfortable to approach me and ask more questions, better questions, deeper questions. I needed them to see me on their level. I needed them to have some hope, and it took some time. And we'll be getting deeper into this later, but Jesus left us an important template to use, I think, when we shine our light into the world. Maybe a work colleague says to you, "I've noticed that you don't use any profanity." Why is that? Why is that? Well, obviously, Ephesians 5:4, and of course, I don't want to go to hell. Is that the answer? You didn't shine your light. You stabbed them in the heart with a lightning bolt is what you did, and they're never going to ask you any more questions after that. Tone it down. Put a filter on it. How about trying, well, to be honest, I've struggled a long time saying things I shouldn't say, and recently, I've been really just trying to follow Christ. That's what that is. That's fishing. That's putting out the bait there. Come on, take it. Ask me another question. This is what Jesus does. This is what Jesus did for us. How many people ask him questions all the time because of the way he lowered himself? He didn't blind them with his light that he had. Meet them on their level. Provide them with hope. And wait on the Lord. Wait on the Lord. Hebrews 4:15-16. "For we do not have a high priest who is unable to empathize with our weakness, but we have one who has been tempted in every way, just as we are, yet he did not sin. Let us therefore approach God's throne with confidence so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help us in our time of need." Hebrews 10:19-23. "Therefore, brethren, having boldness to enter the holiest by the blood of Jesus, by a new and living way which he consecrated for us through the veil, that is his flesh, and having a high priest of the house of God, let us draw near." What's another word for that? Approach. Let us approach with a true heart and full assurance of faith, having our hearts sprinkled from an evil conscience and our bodies washed with pure water. Let us hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering, for he who promised is faithful. And let us consider one another in order to stir up love and good works, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together as the manner of some is, but exhorting one another, and so much the more as you see the day approaching. Moses clothed himself with a veil so the people would approach him. Jesus did the same thing. His veil was his flesh, his humanity. Jesus was a filter so that we could approach the light of God. John 1:17-18. For the law was given through Moses. Grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. No one has ever seen God, but the one and only Son, who is himself God and is in closest relationship with the Father, has made him known. John 6:45 said, as is written in the prophets, they will all be taught by God. Jesus came to the earth as a traveling light, and he was our representation. Not everyone is drawn to Jesus' light. Some reject him because they love the darkness. The big word in American politics right now is polarization, right? Polarization. Both camps think the other guy, or I guess now maybe the other girl, is the most polarizing figure that has ever lived. Right? This is the speak. This is the way that we talk. And they're both wrong, right? The most polarizing figure to ever live was Jesus Christ, our Lord. He was the most polarizing figure to ever live, right? Did he bring peace on earth? What did he say? No, I'm bringing a sword, right? He said he was going to be responsible for the separation of families. That's what he said, and it's true. It's true. We can't be independent. We either are with him in the light or we are in outer darkness. We're going to have to get to our science demonstration today. So light, just regular light, is what we call unpolarized. We're going to pretend that light is traveling in waves, not particles today for today's thing, because it's hard to explain it if it's particles. This is one of those things we have to kind of explain it as waves. And it's, if you have light coming off of a light bulb, it's unpolarized, which means there could be a wave like this, and there could be a wave horizontal and a wave diagonal. Basically, infinite amounts of orientations of the wave, and it goes out. We can put it through a polarizing film. And I thought you might think it looks like that. It doesn't. It kind of looks like this. Basically, it just looks like a film. Okay, and what it it's plastic, and they're inside. It's impregnated with certain long chain molecules that are all lined up, and what it does is it absorbs light and it only lets one plane of the light through. So if you're looking at me right now, there's all kinds of planes hitting my face, but if you look at me, I'm dimmer. no comments on that. Okay, because there's less light coming from my face to you. It's only coming in one plane. And how do you know which plane it is? You can't really tell. Well, I put a little mark right here so I know. So right here, if I have it like this, then the light going through there is just going through the vertical way. Generally, I wasn't sure if there's any other physics people here, but we use kind of a picket fence analogy, which is a really actually bad analogy, but it kind of makes sense to some people. If I had a rope and I was making waves in the rope, if I went through a picket fence, a vertical picket fence, then that would go right on through, right? But if I went through a second picket fence that you turned sideways, then it would stop, right? It wouldn't let it go through, okay? So what happens here is I have two of these, and they're exactly the same. They're exactly the same, okay? But if I have, like, I wasn't really sure how to do this demonstration, but I have a good reflective place, so If we look at it this way, so this is going to be vertical polarization. So if you're looking at my head this way, can you see my head? Okay? And in this one, if I do this one also vertical, you can still see my head, right?
Right.
Can everybody see it or not? There we go. Okay? But if I start rotating this one, now everybody is really happy. Because you can't see my face anymore, right? I know how it is. Okay? So I can totally block the light out. I can see the light. And maybe it's super, super bright light, so I actually want to put a polarizing film on it. You guys do this all the time, right? A lot of you have polarizing glasses. We could actually do some experiments with some of your glasses, probably, with the exact same things as these, right? You have light, and a lot of the light that gets polarized from the sun's not polarized, but it can become polarized if it bounces off the hood of your car, right? Or any ground out in front of you, it'll be polarized horizontally. So your glasses, if you have polarized glasses, they're all the vertical format. Okay, it blocks that thing that's coming off the hood of your car, and it reduces all the glare. That's all these things are. So I was going to try to show you. I still got some time. All right. So maybe we can do it. Oh, I can't do those, can I? Yeah, I can just do those. Okay. I don't understand lights. I gotta blank this thing out too, I think. Can I do that, or am I not in charge of that? Okay. Can you see the light up there? No, I wasn't sure. Okay. This would be God's light, and it's very, very bright. I should have got something brighter. Actually, I do have something brighter. Hold on, I'll use that in a second. So I can put this light over it, and it's a little dimmer, but we still see the light, right? I think about this as representing, this is what Jesus did. Jesus allows us to see the light of God. It allows us to approach the light of God. It's not as bright and it's just going to destroy us, but we can still experience the light of God. This other one will be us. And if I am in alignment with Jesus, right? If I line up, my will aligns with Jesus' will, I obey his commands, then I can still see the light, right? I can still see the light. But if I don't align myself with Jesus, right? If I go 90 degrees to Jesus, completely opposite of what he's telling me to do, and I turn it, then I'm not going to... Yeah! There we go! You got that analogy. All right. Okay? So I can turn the light on and off, basically, by making sure that I'm aligned. Okay? So that wasn't very impressive, actually. I don't know. It wasn't that great. So here I have a laser, which I have to be careful with, because I could hurt you with this, so. It's very, very bright. Okay, and I need a, let's see. I'll do it this way. I would let someone hold it, but it's all right, Brian. That's all right. I'm afraid you're gonna really hurt somebody.
You know me too.
I don't. I can just see. It doesn't even have an on switch because you're not. You can't have it be on because it could be. Okay. You got to just hold it with a button, so you're always in control of what it is. So it's weird. So there's. Can you see that dot or not?
Yeah. Yeah.
Should I go up here on this thing?
No.
Hey, this has wheels on it. If you want to move it.
Okay, can you see that dot?
Yeah.
Okay. So this is a much brighter light. It's pretty, pretty high powerful. If I do this, it kind of refracts it a little bit too. That's kind of cool. Okay. It was just a side view. It wasn't really. So then I can line this one up, and you can still see it, right? But if we turn it 9 degrees, even the laser, we can almost. If I could do it perfectly, I could get it completely out. Actually, you know what? Let's do this. I got a diffractor I can put on this thing. Talk about shining like stars in the universe. I'm really glad I thought about putting that on. This has no spiritual analogy at all. It's just cool. Look at it. Okay, we'll make it right there. And we'll do it again. Still see everything, right? Okay? It's dimmer, because not all the light is going through, right? Just the vertical polarization. And if I line this one up again with it, it's still there. Okay? But what happens to all the stars in the universe, which is us, shining our light on the world, if we all decide
decide we're not going to obey Jesus. We're not going to be lined up with Jesus. And what happens to all our stars? They all go out. Right? And there's no light. We're not going to shine God's light in the world if we're not in alignment with His Son's teaching. He is our representation. He is the traveling light. He has come to the world, and we need to be in His light. It's the only way that we can approach God the Father. I believe you have time. You're on break.